This episode is presented by Shaxbury Cider.
This week on Meatin' 3, we're exploring the culinary wonders of urban New Jersey with a tour through Newark. We speak to Frank Mentisana at Phillips Academy Public Charter School.
This idea of family style and made from scratch lunches continues to be a bit of an anomaly in the city.
We also hear from Gil Speyer from All Points West Distillery.
Newark used to have an incredibly rich beverage alcohol history.
And we'll tour Aero Farms, the world's largest indoor vertical farm.
We're growing using 390 times more productivity than field farming and 95% less water.
Tune in to this week's Meatin' 3 on Heritage Radio Network to be amazed at the wonders of Newark. That's Meat plus sign THREE. Available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Welcome to Beer Sessions Radio on the Heritage Radio Network. Hey guys, it's March 26, 2019. It's the beginning of spring. And we've got a very spring-like theme today. We're going to be talking about cider, New York State cider, with a very interesting group of experts, cider makers, and our good friend, Jen Smith from the New York Cider Association. Jen, how are you?
I'm well, thank you.
It's always a pleasure having you on the show because you've grown so much with the industry and with New York Cider. Just give us a couple updates on what's going on and some of the things that we'll be talking about on the show today.
Sure. We have a couple of projects that are coming to fruition this year. We'll talk, I think, a little more in depth later in the show about the New York Cider brand identity that we've developed. So we have a logo that cider makers using 100% New York fruit can use on their labels, and our tagline is the state of cider. We additionally have some data validation around the dryness scale that we've been developing over the past couple of years. So we're ready to see that go into market, and now we're beginning to think about how to certify the name so that we can guarantee that usage reflects the integrity and the kind of scientific rigor that the scale itself embodies. So that will be a great way for consumers to get to know whether their ciders are sweet or dry.
That's great. We're going to be focusing on New York State cider in the show today. And Tyler from King's Highway Cider, right?
Yes.
So give us your full name, sir.
I'm Tyler Graham with King's Highway. I'm the owner. We started packaging last spring, and we're doing really well in the Hudson Valley, Connecticut, Massachusetts. We're launching in Pennsylvania next week. And, you know, we're doing really well here.
That's great. I mean, we were at a Cider Week event together, and you proposed the show. You have a couple ideas that we were going to talk about today. I know, are you on the board of the New York State Cider Association?
I'm on the marketing committee. And, we were just chatting and thought it would be a good idea to kind of talk about the state of New York cider, considering that we now have this new logo that's promoting 100% New York cider.
Yeah. And what do you think? I mean, they had some questions about, you know, what does it mean to be a New York cider? That's a good starting point. You know, anybody want to join in on that? Is it about apples? Is it about culture?
Well, I think
culture?
A lot of the, you know, what we were talking about on the marketing committee is, you know, any state could have a cider that's 100%, you know, Michigan apples or whatever. And so, you know, part of what we were talking about is what makes a New York cider. And I think it has a lot to do with the culture of New York. I mean, I think that the cider market in New York is really starting to mature. And I think it's a little bit behind maybe some other markets like on the West Coast. If you go upstate, you know, people will tell you, oh, cider's for fall. If you come into the city, you know, in March, everyone's drinking rosé ciders. So I think I would compare it a little bit to the beer market where I think 7 years ago, the New York beer market was, you know, very immature. But now if you look at the packaging, New York beer is the most beautiful packaged beer in the country.
Yeah, it's true. And Gidon, introduce yourself because you're one of my favorite cider guys.
Hey, so my name's Gidon Call. I started Original Sin quite a long time ago, back in 1996. So I've seen the cider industry in New York evolve quite considerably over the years.
I mean, when we first met, I was criticizing your packaging because you were appealing to a nightlife. But back then, I mean, how did you sell cider, you know, over 20 years ago? Didn't we even know what it was?
You know, actually, even the point where you're criticizing me was probably the second or third phase in the company, because that, you know, for the first 12 years, there wasn't any point of sale or really image to speak of. But at some point, that image did take hold, especially in the Lower East Side and East Village, at a time when you really needed that to get bars to get excited about cider and get sell-through. So it's a very different time than it is now, as terms of expertise in the cider category and excitement about the category in general.
And we're going to talk a lot more about new things that you're doing, but also a couple more guests in the room.
I'm Dan Pucci. I have a consulting company called Walba Hospitality. I wear a lot of different cider hats in the industry.
We know you were the palmier at Wassail.
Yeah, back in the day, it was palmier at Wassail.
First cider bar in New York. 2015 that brought so many cider people into this studio.
Yeah, for sure.
Quite a few cider shows back then.
Yeah, absolutely. And since then, I do many, many other things.
Great. And I have another special guest from Heritage Radio Network.
Hey, I'm Jordan Berry. I'm a producer here at HRN, and I do cider research on the language we use to talk about what we're drinking.
That's great. So let's go back to this. So, Jen, I know some things that you've been talking about and studying besides label and marketing, but you talked about a dryness scale for a while. Give me a little backstory on that, and let's talk about what that means for you guys as New York producers and cider experts.
I will. Can I be a pain and jump back for 1 second first and talk a little bit more about the logo and the notion of what New York cider is? And I just want to point out that it's fairly unique in the United States for a farm cidery license class to exist. And what a farm cidery here in New York State means is that it's a cidery that uses 100% local ag. So when we're talking about New York cider, what we mean is that it's fruit that's all grown locally. Now, I'm not, you know, we can debate the relative merits of New York apples versus Massachusetts apples or et cetera. But the point here is that there is not necessarily a guarantee that cider that is from state X is actually made from apples grown in state X, the way that there is that guarantee here in New York.
And actually, if I can make a comment on that one unique element of New York cider is that we have the most diverse selection of apples in the country. And on top of that, we do also have a very diverse variety of ciders being made, which, again, the Finger Lakes is certainly very different than you get in other portions. So
great.
I think, I'm going to pour a cider right here called Little Scrumpy, and this just kind of shows you that just apples.
King's Highway.
King's Highway, Little Scrumpy. And this is just made from apples that have just been around for 100 years on the side of the road. And it's got, like, a little bit of a funk to it, but not any kind of bacterial or yeast funk. It's just the tannins on the apples. And these apples are all over the place where we are up in Eastern Dutchess County. But I think one of the big things that this idea of doing 100% New York apples is going to help the industry with is getting better apples into the ground. We're talking about, you know, when we buy these apples from growers right now, they'll have excess cider apples and they don't have anything to do with them at the last minute in the season, and then we can get them for cheap. But what we want is we want to pay more for them. We want to pay twice the price of them and know that we're going to have them in August, September, and, you know, really grow the industry.
Yeah, I think it's really important, especially because we do have the most amount of cideries of any other state in the country. We are the leading, and I think Jen said we have a really diversity of producers here as well. Like Yudan was saying, we do have the Finger Lakes, which makes a very unique style of cider versus the Hudson Valley, and we have ciders in 750s and in cans and in kind of all different formats and draft and serving in wine glass and pint glasses. And it's kind of amazing the diversity we have within the state.
That's a good start, right, Jen?
And I'll point out in the varieties we're using for those ciders as well. We're using culinary varieties, we're using bittersweet varieties, we're using heirloom varieties, and it's all kind of maxed together. And New York State's really driving a lot of the rest of the country as well. A lot of our orchards out in Western New York are making cider, are growing apples and making cider for cider makers around the country. So it's pretty impressive.
Yeah. And then to talk about the dryness scale, you asked me about that?
Sure.
Okay. So there is a demonstration.
The reason I say that is because we want to talk about a label. We want to talk about growing better apples in
this
New
is
York.
Delicious cider.
And people knowing that New York has great apples that make great cider. But an important for me, an important direction for this industry is dryness, you know? What is dry and how do people know?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, sadly, we tend to demonize and effeminize sweetness, which is not in and of itself inherently bad. I think that there are sweet ciders that I would take 9 times out of 10 over a dry cider because they're balanced. But, you know, it's the imbalanced ciders that give sweet cider a bad rep. But that aside, you know, consumers don't understand what dryness is. They do understand what they like to drink, but they can't quite, connect between what that dryness or sweetness is and what they're enjoying. And so we've developed this scale that will standardize based on residual sugar and total acidity. And then if there are a substantial amount of tannins present, also adjusting for tannins, what the flavor experience is going to be for them as they, you know, are enjoying it in the glass. And so building upon that and creating a custom framework, a constant framework for it, will be able to help acclimatize drinkers to what they want to drink.
A number scale, like a 1 to 10?
Yeah, it's a, 0 to 4 from dry to sweet. And your particular cider falls where it falls in between, and it's dry, semi-dry, semi-sweet, sweet are the hash marks. And, the New York Cider Association considers our colleagues in the Northeast to really be kin. Like, we have a lot of the same concerns, we have a lot of the same objectives, we have a lot of the same opportunities. Interestingly, the first person to have the official dryness scale and market is Eden Ciders from Vermont. Eleanor just texted me a picture this morning. The cans just came off the line, and they've got the scale on there. So
cool.
Excited about that.
And do you think that for you guys as cider makers and experts, I mean, does that help you in your marketing to know that there's a scale that people can relate to? And would you make ciders for a number? Like, I want to make it a dryness 3. I want to make a dryness 7.
Well, so at King's Highway, we do everything we ferment all the sugar out. So it's always 0 grams residual sugar. And like Jen was mentioning, I mean, it's actually very confusing for the consumer right now, because the way I like to explain is, if you take a Coca-Cola and just keep adding acid to it, eventually you can't taste the sugar anymore. And you wouldn't know that there's 32 grams of sugar. So a lot of dry markets out on the market right now, they'll say dry and then there's, 10, 12 grams of sugar. So I think this will really kind of help start to rein this in so that consumers can kind of start to understand what's going on.
Well, I think a big problem in the cider industry today across the country is kind of a failure of expectations among the cider consumer, in which you don't necessarily understand what this cider should taste like. I see that it says these things on it, but what does it actually mean? There are a lot of language, like Jordan's been working on the last few years, in terms of like understanding what the language actually has and actually maybe has some value to it or no value to it at all. And people understanding what varieties will taste like and things like that. But I think having this dryness is the first conversation, because at Wassail, at least, a lot of the first conversation we had with people were about, is this cider dry? And I'm like, is it dry? And now we're ready for the next conversation. But if we can get past that first point of entry, then it will hopefully open up more conversations. Jordan?
Yeah, I agree. My data set looks at 500 labels from around the country, and it's basically a frequency list of all the words that producers are using to communicate directly with the drinkers on the labels. And the number one word by a landslide is no surprise to anyone here. It's dry. And that's separating out all the other uses, the semi-dry and medium dry. It's just dry on its own. And the variety of ciders that word shows up on is way bigger than you would expect it to be as a first-time cider drinker.
Well, this is very interesting, because let's say champagne, that everyone knows what champagne is. If I ask you, what's Brut, Sec, and Demi-Sec, do you know the difference? Does anyone?
Yes.
You do. Tell us, Tyler.
Yeah. I mean, Brut's dry. That's why, our sort of flagship right now is
0 to 12 grams per liter of sugar.
0 grams sugar.
0 to 12.
You got the numbers down. And what's Sec and what's Demi Sec?
I think Sec is 12 to 23. Demi Sec is like 23 to 38 or 42, something like that. I used to remember.
So you got a level 1 master sommelier.
I'm going champagne industry has down some kind of a dryness scale. How is the cider scale going to compare with that or learn from it?
Interestingly, ours evolved from the International Riesling scale. right? So that's taking the mystification around whether Riesling is sweet or dry and clarifying it for the consumer. It was introduced in the late 90s, I believe. Actually, it was an international committee, but based in the Finger Lakes. And ours is built from it in the sense that they use residual sugar and total acidity, and they adjust for pH. And we don't adjust for pH, but we do adjust for total tannin content where it's present. It doesn't necessarily have to be. So they saw, and by they, I mean the sort of global Riesling industry, they saw unparalleled growth in their category in the years following the introduction of the scale. So there's sort of a universal regard for it as an effective consumer communication tool. Now, there are people who might quibble with how it's used, and they very much took a backseat around regulating it. So you'll see it on a, you know, New Zealand Sauvignon Blanc, and does it belong there, and what does it mean at that point? But for a core group of Rieslings, it really helped consumers connect with what do I like, and is this particular wine one that I'll like. So we're hoping to replicate that.
Yeah. You know, for me, one thing is, you know, having been a retail buyer and whatever, sommelier guy forever, I felt like I had to spend so much time tasting different producers' products just to figure out what their dryness scale was in anything, any category, wine, beer, cider.
Yeah, I think what John's saying is very much informs the expectations for Riesling, and really help them like evolve and grow, and people are more comfortable in buying those products. I think with cider, we're going to have the same results with this. With your state dryness scale, and people are going to be more willing to give cider a chance once they are reassured that it is actually a dry cider.
Great. And I think also, just as a consumer, just to say, you know, if I'm drinking something that's 100% dry at lunch, it's got, you know, the ABV is 6%. I can have a cheeseburger, go back to work. You know, I don't have this like slump. But if it's something that's sweeter, maybe that's something that I would have at the end of a meal at night to help me go to sleep. So I do think it's very important.
I want to jump to a different thing. We've got a lot to talk about. You know, we're talking about things like how cider's presented. You know, large format bottles like wine versus cans. But let's talk about something else. Let's talk about cider versus beer, or cider versus wine, because I feel like there's a finite market for beer. Beer is a huge market. You know, the beer companies take out Super Bowl ads, but I don't really think that market's growing. I feel like I've seen cider, you know, a typical like mainstream Upper West Side restaurant now with six drafts. Now it's becoming more standard to have one line of cider. So you're seeing growth in cider. So, you know, who wants to sum up, where is cider? Is it going after beer drinkers? Is it going after wine drinkers?
Well, I'll just say one thing that I tell drinkers who aren't maybe necessarily familiar with nicer ciders is very well executed sour beers that are blended from barrels, very well executed wines that are blended from barrels, and very well executed ciders that are blended from barrels all have a very similar thing going on.
You know, I think also the cider industry is very bifurcated in terms of, one, there are certain drinkers that
bifurcated?
Want... like certain.
Is that a process in cider making?
But I think there's certain
bifurcation people... patented by...
But I think there's certain people that want dry ciders as opposed to sweet ciders. It's also, when you go into other markets, the level of sophistication per market is very different from market to market. And I think that's one of the major confusions when they start using words like dryness. The dryness in certain parts of this country means something different than it might be in New York, where people are obviously much more sophisticated. So, and then that once again even happens even more so than you're talking about, you know, 12-ounce cans as opposed to wine bottles. We're all in the same room, but in many ways, it's two separate types of ciders that are being produced, or two separate markets that are being, they're consuming the product. There is overlap, but not to a great extent.
Well, I feel like when I'm in a Dan Pucci tasting, I only get cider in fancy wine bottles.
Not always true. We have cans. I usually sell canned ciders as well. But I think there is definitely that kind of like diversion of the market, like you know what I'm saying. But also, there is also, I think, a spectrum as well that exists. And there's like the products that exist that are made by macro brands from concentrate are different from the brands that are the more regional brands that are made from fresh apples versus the ones that are made from apples they purchased from somebody else versus the people who are growing estate-grown apples and things like that. And there's kind of a long spectrum of different ciders that exist within the marketplace.
You know, unfortunately, in this country, 75% of ciders in this country are still made out of concentrate. And also, the level of knowledge in this country is still so limited that if you go into bars, you'll be shocked at the lack of knowledge when it comes to cider.
That's great. We're going to take a short break, guys. We'll be back in 1 minute on Beer Sessions Radio. All right.
This episode is brought to you by Shaxbury Cider, who believe cider can be daring, complex, and eminently drinkable. Located in Vergennes, Vermont, Shaxbury make a broad offering of ciders, from the bright and fruity rosé to inventive small-batch wild apple fermentation. Each fall, Shaxbury takes to the hills of Vermont to forage for the wild and forgotten fruit that make up their Lost Apple Project. Shaxbury, producer of the first American-made Pet Nat cider, continues to experiment every year with limited edition ciders designed to spotlight locally foraged fruit. To learn more, visit Shaxbury.com or follow them on Instagram at Shaxbury.
You guys can ask questions if you're searching. Hey, welcome back to Beer Sessions Radio on the Heritage Radio Network. Check us out, heritageradionetwork.org. It's our 10th anniversary. Every month there's some new Hall of Fame announcements and a lot of great things going on, heritageradionetwork.org. We also forgot we have a calling guest out there, a very special wine and cider shop owner up in the Fishkill, New York.
Yep.
Paige from Boutique Wines. Paolo, Paige, can you hear me?
I can hear you. How are you guys doing?
Great. Have you been listening in to the show?
Absolutely.
Great. So just give us a quick... I mean, Tyler thought it was very important that we had you call in. You know, you're of a retail operation. Just tell us what, you know, the ciders that you're selling and your take on the New York cider industry.
Yeah, I mean, we have almost 150 different SKUs in the store at this point, including 13 on tap. We're one of two retailers in New York State that has taps of cider. So we carry 13 on tap, mostly from New York, although we do have a few Vermont and sometimes some European ciders as well. But our store is centered around New York and more New York cider makers than others.
Great. And Tyler, why did you invite Paige to come on? Because I know that you helped pick all the guests for the show today.
Well, I think she has an interesting perspective. I think in New York, we do have this thing going on a little bit where is good cider just in 750 bottles or can it be in cans? Or, you know, when I've been to Portland, Oregon or California, I just feel like people don't... nitpick as much. They're just like, I like cider. Okay, there's the cider. And so I think Paige has a unique perspective because she's kind of in Fishkill there, she's kind of like the gateway to the Hudson Valley. A lot of people stop in there because she has such a large selection. And so I thought a lot of times we don't hear that voice from the retailer in these conversations. So I thought she would be a great person to add.
Great. So let's all ask Paige questions.
Yes, Paige, what are kind of the consumer expectations when they show up at your store and they kind of want to buy a cider, what makes them choose a 750 versus a single serving can or format?
Well, I mean, so it's interesting. I mean, since we have wines, spirits, and ciders in here, I would say, you know, only about a third of my customers come in specifically for ciders. I have other customers that come in for other things. So one of the first things I do when somebody comes in for wine is I kind of introduce them to ciders and I bring them over to our tap system and kind of walk them through some of the taps. And a lot of times a wine drinker will tell me, well, I don't like cider because cider's sweet. And then I have to kind of give them a little bit of an education and find out what sort of wines they drink. And then based on that portfolio of what they're drinking in a wine, I can then start to choose ciders off my taps for them to taste. And oftentimes, you know, depending on what I pick, they'll tell me, oh, this cider tastes a lot like a wine. And I'm like, well, yeah, there's a lot of similarities between the two industries and how they're used. You just haven't been exposed to that. And one of the funny things I always tell people, when they finally discover ciders for the first time, I say to them, if you tell me you don't like cider because it's sweet, that's like telling me, I don't like wine. I've had Manischewitz before, and I don't like that one. So I don't like all wine. It's kind of like saying, I don't like cider because I've had, pick a big brand name and fill in the blank there. Like there's other ones out there, and kind of have them explore a little bit. So back to your original question about the format size, you know, I've found that a lot of the younger people seem to like those cans because their tastes are different than what you would find in the 750s. We see a lot more of the heritage ciders and the drier style ciders in the 750s. And so I tend to have an older crowd that kind of goes to those style packaging versus the cans.
Hold on a second. Quick, Tyler, you just poured a can of your cider. What was that?
That was the Brut, I think, that we were just
So doing. The King's Highway
There's
Brut?
There's a Brut and a Rosé out here.
And then, Dan, you just poured something.
I just poured some of the Carr's Cider House from Western Mass, from Haley. This is their Yarlington Mill single variety.
And Paige, since we're talking
Paige,
to
that's
you,
why you got to be in here, yeah. In studio.
Next time, come down. But let's say right now I'm at your spot, and I'm one of those customers that just walked in, and I want to try some ciders. Tell me, like, three ciders that you would taste me on today.
Three ciders that are on my tap that I would taste you on today.
Sure.
I would absolutely taste you on Penning's Farm Cider. They have something called Iron Mountain, which almost tastes like the peel of an apple, and it's very cool, made right here in the Hudson Valley. I love that. I'd absolutely taste you on King's Highway's Whip Appeal, which we always run on tap as well, because it's got an incredibly great guava flavor on the front, and it is my gateway of explaining to people the difference between fruit and sweetness. Great. And so we always taste on that. And the third one, that's a little difficult. Probably Orchard Hills Verde Cider. I run that in my tree tap. We actually have a 15-foot tree with a tap in it, and I almost always run Orchard Hill in there. And I like that because that cider actually hits almost everybody's palate. It is so amazing. From sweet to dry, almost everybody likes that cider.
Wow. Tyler, thanks for bringing in Paige. I think I'm going to take a drive up to Fishkill just to
she
go to the
like
store.
She has like 16 or 18 tap lines. It's crazy.
Amazing. Let's go to Gideon. So, Gideon, we started talking about, you know, I've known you a long time. You're one of the pioneers in selling cider in New York, but you've made a big jump the last few years. So tell us about the Orchard and why you've committed to having an orchard in New York and your visions for terroir-driven ciders.
You know, I have a my family used to have a dairy farm. I went to actually school for veterinary medicine, and unfortunately our farm went out of business many years ago. So we had land in the Hudson Valley, and about 10 years ago, as a result of going to some great cider events, which include going to Cider Days in Greenfield, Massachusetts, as well as visiting the USD orchards in Geneva, New York, I really became a lot more knowledgeable and interested in apples in general. And so many, if you look at the golden age of pomology, the study of fruit trees, is the 19th century. And if you look back at the literature, people were so passionate of the apples they grew. And upon reading upon this literature, there are many apples that weren't available. And I went out of my way to try to find many of these apples. Many of these were endangered apples. Endangered apples defined as an apple that's being offered by less than three nurseries. And apples are really almost impossible to find. And to the intent of my test orchard, it's only 2 acres with dwarf trees. It's to grow many apples that really can't be found. From the main reason is because I personally want to try them. So,
how many varieties do you have there?
We have 150 varieties. And actually, I think one incredibly important point for my orchard is that I've found that in general, apples that are not indigenous to the States tend not to do as well. Some do, but many do not do as well in the States. And looking once again back in literature, there's all this early literature about how growing European apples didn't necessarily were almost worthless when growing in the States. One of the problems of the cider industry currently is there's such an attempt to take European cider apples and grow them in the States, where really what this country needs to do is develop their own indigenous cider apples and propagate them.
And why don't you tell people how that happens?
That's a good one.
The propagation?
Well, I was also going to say that there's also so many out there.
There are
all those
trees
out
actually,
there.
Tyler has a
single varietal Harrison, which is a very famous Afro-Newark. And the greatest cider in this country in the early days of our country was known to grow in Newark, New Jersey. When Newark, New Jersey had so many famous apples, that's obviously one amazing apple. But propagation happens through grafting, which is a very simple process, which can be learned pretty easily. And I actually, right now, this next week, I'll be grafting myself. Every year I collect some very strange, unusual varieties and grow them, because the most exciting thing every year is with my orchard is that every year I have at least 30 or 40 new varieties, or a certain number of new varieties that are harvested for the first time, which keeps it fun and interesting.
A couple years ago, Guidon invited me over to his house because he actually lives very close to our cidery, and I didn't know what to expect. And then all of a sudden, I'm looking at all these apples that I've read about in books and everything, just sitting there. And I said, "Can I use these?" And right now, we're drinking Ashmead's Kernel,
which is awesome,
and it's amazing. Oh, yeah.
So at the end of the year, I'll cruise over there after I get coffee in the morning and just grab what's around, because I like the really high brick ciders in November, December. The Ashmead's, I think, is 9%.
Yeah, it tastes like
Harrison's like 8.5%, and then we have a Wixen that we'll try and bid it that's 10.5%. But you know, before I started making cider, I heard all this.
Did you get these apples from Guidon's?
Yeah, these are from his orchard.
So you made these small
batches?
Yeah, I made
small batches. Like, if there's, you know, the Wixens, they're the latest apples, and they look, it's just like these ribbons. It looks like cranberries on a apple tree. They were discovered in California, I think, 80 yep. years ago, but it's a phenomenal crab apple. And so, yeah, if they're all sitting there, okay, I'll make 30 gallons of this, 20 gallons of that, and just see what it is, because it's amazing to be able to work with the apples. And before I started making cider, I heard all these people saying, oh, you can't make single varietals. It's going to taste like shit. These have to be blended. These aren't supposed to be on their own. And I've found the complete opposite. And there's a guy actually out in Colorado named Dan Haken who's makes all these phenomenal single varietal ciders.
Well, the minute you poured one of these, Dan here got so excited.
Yeah, well, I love Ashmead's Kernel as an apple, and it is so delicious. Mm. It has so much texture and weight and phenolics, and it's savory and fruity at the same time. It's a lot of stuff.
And the great thing about the Ashmead's Kernel Fort Orchard is that it's actually a dual-purpose apple, so it's as good as an eating apple as a cider apple.
So yeah, it does taste really good.
So we're kind of talking about Terroir, but we're really talking more about particular apple varieties that are growing in New York. But Jen, is there anything that on the state level that's going on talking about terroir and you know, specific trees that are being recommended to be planted, or is there a planting plan for
sure.
New York State?
So, on the one hand, we have a huge apple industry here in New York State, and there are a lot of Guidon, you just mentioned dual purpose. There are a lot of dual purpose apples, which means they could be used for cider, they could be used for cooking, they could be used as dessert fruit you'd eat out of hand. So we have a lot of trees. We have Cornell doing a lot of really important research primarily on European varieties that have high tannins or really super high acidity. And then there's also a lot of energy going into finding wild apples and this goes to what Guidon was saying about how maybe the answer isn't looking to Europe as much as developing our own varieties here in New York. And so we see a lot of advancement in all three of those categories. And again, that's one of the reasons that we're so high potential. Now, to talk about terroir, it's early days. You know, do we have microclimates and soil differences? Of course. Does an apple grown, you know, on the slope on the side of Lake Cayuga taste different than in a fertile field in Fishkill? Quite possibly. But how we're quantifying those differences is still a work in progress. All that said, we do think that there's a way to approach a very high-level concept of terroir by saying, okay, these apples were not just grown in New York, but they're one of a set of varieties that grow well in New York and demonstrate the kind of characteristics that we think cider could and should have. So that's sort of our baby step towards designating terroir, is to have geographical distinction.
Dan?
Well, I think looking back in a lot of the 19th century research, it all talks about basically apples of a place. It talks a lot about how certain Cox and Beach talk all about how certain apples grow in certain places and they really excel the best. You talk about like Spitzenberg does really well And both of them talk about Pismerchus really well in the northern Hudson Valley, then especially in like the Schoharie Valley. Now that's really the place for it to grow. And it tastes good other places, but it's really best right there. And I think in our next generation, and reading a lot about like about Newark cider, we're drinking a Harrison right now from the Kings Highway.
Yeah.
And like Harrison's an apple variety from Newark.
From
Newark, New Jersey. And it's a lot of the literature back then says like basically the reason why Newark cider was so good was because of this apple variety. And apple variety did so well in Newark because it was from Newark, and it did like the two things were kind of were linked. It wasn't because of Harrison itself, but Harrison in New Jersey did really well.
You know what's exciting about this show? We've talked for so many years about, you know, farm breweries, farm cideries, farm tourism, you know, and this is the first show that's made me really want to go explore New York State. I mean, you mentioned Schoharie County and the shores of Lake Cayuga. Should I go visit all these places?
Yes.
You should. You should, you know, check out the Lake Ontario fruit growing region. You should check out Western New York, the Finger Lakes, Hudson Valley. We've got some folks up in the Berkshires who are growing fruit and making cider as well. We've got the Catskills say the Hudson Valley? The Hudson Valley is the best known. If I overlooked it, it's only because it's at the tip of everyone's tongue.
But I want to make a statement that when you even look at New York City, that New York City itself has a crazy and very important history in the history of apple growing in our country. The Barry in Dutch means farm, and it, once upon a time, the Barry was an orchard that Peter Stuyvesant grew. And the corner of 13th and 3rd is a plaque of the very first grafted pear tree ever brought to this country, which stood there for many hundreds of years. The very first horticultural society was started on Greenwich Street. And the most important nursery in the history of this country was started in Queens. And the most important historical literature when it comes to the early days of apple growing in our country and horticulture in general was the William Prince Nursery from Flushing, Queens. So you can't underestimate the importance of New York.
I just want to say, too, we're drinking this Harrison now. We had the Ashmeads before. And there's just like a little bit of the smokiness to the Harrison. It's a totally different cider. Mm-hmm. It's a few degrees off. They're made the same way. But for me, I think that's such an exciting thing. I think we will get terroir, but I don't think we're there yet. I can see in 10 years, you know, here's how the Gold Rush are on Long Island. Here's how they are, you know, up near the Finger Lakes. But this last year, we had so much rain in the Hudson Valley. The apples taste nothing like they tasted the year before. And that's from just a huge...
You know, I think 4 or 5 years ago, we did a show with just Kingston Black varietals. Are there any commercially available ciders that are being marketed as single varietals?
For sure, yeah.
Increasingly
more so. I think it's a really important part of at Wassail. It was very important. People knew the variety of things. Apple, it was the cider, it was very helpful in terms of selling the actual product.
Yeah, there's a romance to it as well. And, you know, the word in, you know, let's say the 2010 era of cider in the United States was that you should be blending, that cider is meant to be blended. And we've really seen evolution in that, in the mindset around it and the quality of ciders that are being made out of single varieties. And that's a happy coincidence with the fact that drinkers really respond to single varieties, that there is this sort of compelling notion that like, it's not just apples, it's that kind of apple that maybe I can see at the farmer's market, or maybe I've seen growing on a tree, or maybe, you know, has some kind of history to it.
Yeah, the word like Northern Spy has a place in someone's brain, even though I don't know exactly what it is, it still exists somewhere in their like on their subconscious.
Jordan?
2 years ago for Cider Week, Dan, we put together an event with 16 different single varietal Newtown Pippin ciders from around the country and around the world. And that was not even all of the Newtown Pippin ciders we could have gotten.
Yeah. Actually, sorry, if I can make one point. In 1898, a British chemist analyzed the American Newtown Pippin at the Royal Society of Chemistry in England to decide, that question is, why is the Newtown Pippin single varietal better than English ciders? And he analyzed it, and his claim was that there's nothing artificial in the cider, it just simply was a great cider apple. So to say that there isn't a history of single varietal ciders is really not the case.
I think 18, more
1898.
Yeah, wasn't the Harrison the Champagne of Americas?
Yeah, Harrison's. I think the blending thing is probably comes from more of a European tradition of in England, where they basically would grow a lot of different apples and blend them together, and they developed a very. The English and the French models are very different than the models that existed in this country 100 years ago.
Yeah, and primarily cider was made at the homestead level here more than as a commercial product. And so you're going to make cider out of what's growing in your backyard.
Or what grows that year.
Right, right. But at least like in Newark especially, like the reason why Newark cider was so good in terms of like the 19th century was cause of the varieties they put in it. And that was the real like, hey, you're going to buy this stuff and like you're going to buy it. They used to sell it all up and down the East Coast. All the South was people were buying Newark cider. And it was cause of the consistency of the varieties. It wasn't the same seedling, whatever they were having, inconsistency that was around the rest of the country. It was actually a real variety that was consistent. And as a consumer, it had a certain amount of expectation.
Cachet.
Which is, yeah, cachet, but also like, you knew what you were drinking. Same thing today when we're trying to build out an idea of expectations for people to consumers. In the 19th century, New York cider did the same thing for cider consumers.
It does make sense because I'd like to say that even though I've been tasting ciders with you guys for many years, I couldn't tell you the difference between a Newtown Pippin or a Harrison. Although, I think Ashmead Colonel is the coolest name. So this is really, really promising conversation. Guido, one quick thing before we take our next break.
Okay, well, I was going to say, well, one point on the New Jersey ciders, with kind of following with Dan's point, is actually this really one cool historical fact that the Harrison combined with the Campfield was considered to be particularly wonderful cider. Campfield is another New Jersey apple, and it would sell in New York markets for several times the price of other ciders because it was so well-respected. And you'll find a lot of that. Those references in literature, how great New Jersey cider was.
Great. We're going to take... I know, it's awesome. Quick, what was the Cars we had, Dan?
We had the Cars Yarlington Mill.
And where's Cars from?
They're in Western Mass in the Southern Berkshires. They're in Haley, which is near Northampton.
One of those towns.
Yeah.
Right. We're taking another short break. We'll be back in a minute on Beer Sessions Radio. All right. Practicing my guitar, but this is a pretty cool show, guys. Welcome back. Beer Sessions Radio, heritageradionetwork.org. The Cider Show. It was going to be a cider controversy show, but the controversy is, there's a fact that we're actually talking.
Why are more people drinking it?
We're talking about cider, and I think it's one of the most interesting beverages out there right now. But, Danny, just want to take a step back. I think that big part of the growth of an industry is actually learning from the market. Like, we have Paige on air, and she's talking about tasting people that are interested in wine. They're going to taste cider. But you with Wassail, to me, that's still, it's a seminal moment because in 2015, it was the first cider bar in New York City. You had cider makers from all over the country flying in to do tastings because there was nothing else like it before. But again, you must have learned so much from the questions people had, because anyone interested in cider went to that bar, but they must have all come from different, the expectation levels must have been very different.
Yeah, totally. I had no idea we were sitting into that project, but it was very much the thing where, people were super hungry and curious to taste cider, but they didn't really have the language to actually understand how to communicate what they actually wanted. And our staff, when we first started, didn't really have the language either to really communicate what these products were to the people that they were asking for. And like, well, they're all good. Just like, what good do you really want? And for the first like 2 months, we gave away so many samples of things. And just like, for me, it was like clarifying language on menus and dialing things in terms of creating what people wanted out of the beverages to kind of like
So we basically went from everyone trying six samples to trying no samples. And it was in pretty fast time, just for like kind of just changing the language on how we presented the products.
And then in terms of cider education, I mean, in someone like Jordan, I mean, we can give everyone a little background. I mean, there's other regions in the world where cider's been part of their traditions. Are there any that you look to for inspiration, or that current cider makers are looking to, or is everyone just focused on making their own product?
Oh, totally. And we were recently all over at the USACM CiderCon in Chicago in February, and one of my favorite sessions there was about Spanish style cider making, but in the U.S. and how we use that influence and that tradition to make products here that maybe are referential of that or respectful of that, but are completely our own thing because we're not growing the same apples. So back to the conversation about what apples we're growing, it's awesome to look at these traditions and consumers who have traveled abroad and gone to a choch in Spain or had cider in Brittany. They have an expectation of what it is, and so we can use that language, but to talk about it in kind of what we're doing here and what our traditions that we're building, I think is a really cool opportunity.
If you want controversy, Jimmy, I will say that I think a lot of people do talk about funkiness in cider, and there's I think one problem in the market might be that there are some funkiness in bottles that isn't. It's not intentional. It's not good. And you're spending $40 for the bottle. And then people are reporting back, yeah, I don't really like dry cider. And it's like, well, that's not really what that was. Or I've even seen it at festivals where people are pouring it. And it's just, so but I think that's a challenge for the New York State.
You might have that problem anywhere where people don't really know what the styles are, what they should be.
I don't taste it in beer. And I taste a lot of beer. I did a while ago, but I don't taste it anymore.
Yeah, but I think a lot of that has about a certain amount of expectations, because like when people would, especially in the Spanish context, like Jen and I went to Spain last year, and it was very enlightening in terms of the culture that exists there and how what the things they're doing right, things they're doing wrong there, and coming back here and realizing that so much of the Spanish cider that people are selling Spanish style cider made domestically is just bad cider that people are selling as good cider as Spanish inspired.
Just let it all hang out, cider.
Right, which is like this. Oh, the cider just has
is. This is the controversy we weren't supposed to talk about.
Cider is just bacterial, and if you wanted to make a Spanish this is a Spanish style cider, if it's like a 4-year-old bottle of Spanish cider, then yes, this is a Spanish style cider, but it doesn't have any of the same life and vibrancy that a Spanish cider should have. It just has lactobacillus.
We have a long way to go, but I want to, since I got two cider makers in the room, building on what Jordan said, are there any traditions that inspired you when you were first making cider? I mean, are you just fermenting, or are you looking to France or Spain or England for your cider making techniques?
Tyler? I mean, I like all styles. I like all, you know, well executed cider, and I just, what I really love about cider is the story of it. People have been making it for thousands of years. The Romans brought it to England. It's, you know, it was, you can find these paintings of the old presses with the horse and the concrete trough on Long Island from like 1638. I mean, this stuff has been here forever, and it's cool to see it coming back.
I think, you know, going back to 1996, you know,
1898
to 1996. I'm not quite that old, but like the you know, when I launched, Balmer's launched Woodpecker in the States, even though Strongbow was the most popular cider in England, because they thought Americans like a sweeter palate. So the bar was so low in those days in terms of people wanting, you know, there's only really sweet ciders available. So when I started, the intent was to make a dry cider. So you're saying my inspiration was a dry European cider, as much as I knew at that point in time, and offer it to the market. So a cider that would be borderline what beer drinkers would have, which obviously has evolved considerably from that point in time.
So Jen, the market as a state cider association, it's you got to be pretty sophisticated to navigate your way through this.
Yes and no. I think, and Paige touched on younger consumers and differences with younger consumers. And so something that I think is really positive or hopeful is that we're every year having more drinkers come online for whom cider isn't a new concept, right? That's been in the market. So there's not this barrier to get over.
It's not an alternative anymore.
Right. It's not an alternative. It's not unknown. And so people are gaining confidence, and by people, I mean drinkers, are gaining confidence around, you know, just the, you know, there's so much intimidation around drinking and being sophisticated enough and talking about it the right way and asking for dry and et cetera. And I think that's decreasing year over year with cider.
And let's switch this up because we're running out of time, but the can question. So the thing about cans is let's talk about your shift to cans, Geeden, because for so long you had bottles and draft.
You know, there's been obviously a huge shift in the craft beer industry towards cans, which obviously craft cider industry is very impacted by the craft beer industry. But I do recall a couple years ago to the CiderCon, the National Cider Conference, and with this Nielsen data making the point that canned cider had gone up several percentages while bottled cider had gone down. So clearly there's a move for certain people that cans is a more appealing
profile.
And we're
seeing top tier ciders like Eden and even Farnham Hill has cans. But what I'm trying to say is that going to be the right direction for cider? Because I think cans are a great way to deliver it, same as beer, but I want someone to spin that for me.
I actually have a question for Paige. Paige, are you still there? Are you still there?
Yep, I'm here.
All right.
So what would happen if somebody put a bunch of single varietal ciders and cans in your shop? Are 20-year-old kids going to buy that? Because I have this feeling that, like, 20-year-olds do not care about...
21-year-olds.
21.
I was going to
Good
correct
point.
You and say we proof everybody here. You have to be 21. Okay, so that's a loaded question, and I'll tell you why. In terms of single varietals and going back to what you guys were talking about before, since we put a single varietal cider on tap, I've seen a trend of people asking for single varietal. So we happen to get Hudson Valley Farmhouse's Northern Spy on tap. And I've run it on tap probably about 4 months now. And in explaining what that is and what that means to the consumer, they started asking questions about what other single varietal ciders do I have in the store. So I've brought in more single varietal ciders overall, including other Northern Spy and Kingston Black, that kind of stuff. So because I'm tasting it on the tap, that's what changes the equation here. If I just had them sitting on a shelf, then, yeah, you definitely have a problem. But if I'm tasting them out on tap and I can explain what a single varietal is, that sparks an interest. And, yes, the younger generation is interested in it.
If I can make a remark.
So there's still a market for draft.
We just came out with four. We have a series of four single varietals coming out. One is the McIntosh, which Jen's pouring now and Jordan's drinking now, and hopefully everyone else is going to have it at some point. I think that what I've learned over the years is the more you talk about apples, especially if you can talk about depth, the more people latch onto it. It's just simply that people don't know enough about it to get excited about it. So if you can talk about it in a way that's exciting, people really get into it.
Can I get a marketing wonk for a second?
Go for it.
So what we find, you know, looking at Nielsen data and just larger cultural trends is that younger drinkers don't identify by beverage type. They are what we call occasional drinkers. So they drink by occasion. They want something that they can take with them and, you know, enjoy on a hike or at a picnic or et cetera. You know, Steve Wood always makes the joke about how many times you go on a picnic on a year. But you know what? You know, here in New York City, there's a lot of using parks as your living room. So there are a lot of picnics. And
about 50,000 people every day in Prospect Park.
Right, exactly.
So, I have a first picnic planned for Saturday. It's going to be 65 degrees in New York.
Wait, what are you bringing on that picnic?
It's definitely going to be cider.
And canned cider, probably.
Yeah. Yeah, so you can take canned cider with you, and it's lower alcohol, so it's an easy to drink.
This is an amazing show. We're going to do many more cider shows, of course. So happy that you guys came on. Anyone want to wrap it up? Any other final statements?
I actually want to make one very important point, I think, is that some of the most important work done in the country right now is being done by Cornell University and Greg Peck and his graduate students in terms of analyzing cider apples and deciding what direction this industry needs to go, specifically in terms of profitability for orchardists. And in England, the Long Ashton Research Center had a significant impact on English cider industry, and I think Cornell of the long run will have the same. So,
yeah, Greg's new study is really, really amazing and really gives a lot of backbone to a lot of things that people have been saying for many years in terms of the profitability of orchards and kind of understanding the long-term viability of cider as an important part of New York City agriculture.
Great. Anybody else? All right. This is a great show. I just want to say, Paige, it is so great having you call in. I'm a big advocate of great retail establishments from beer bars to wine stores. So thank you so much for sharing your expertise.
That was awesome. Thank you for having me.
All right. Fishkill, New York, right? Boutique Wine?
Boutique Wine, Spirits and Cider in Fishkill, New York.
All right. And everybody else, just give us a quick, your name and your whatever, and sign off with us.
Jen Smith, Executive Director, New York Cider Association, Cider Week, Hudson Valley, coming at you in June.
Rock on.
Jordan Berry, Heritage Radio Network producer and cider language researcher.
Tyler Graham, Kings Highway, Fine Cider.
Original Sin, Gidon Call. Getting a little old over there, but I'm okay.
The original.
Dan Bougie, Wild About Hospitality.
This is great. Thanks for joining us. Big shout out to our producers, Justin Kennedy, engineer Matt Patterson, our new intern, Aaliyah Papes, and I'm Jimmy Carboni, the host. Thanks for joining us here on the Heritage Radio Network. We'll catch you next time on Beer Sessions Radio. All right. Woo! Yeah.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.